The longest ballot in decades awaits voters in Florida this November. Why so long? Well, it's because of a dozen. Yes, a dozen proposed constitutional amendments that you, the voter, will decide. What they all mean, coming up. And good morning. We are live, as always, from Studio 5 for First Coast Connect this morning. I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. And just ahead, before you vote on all those ballot amendments, we've got an explainer for you on just what they would do to revise the state constitution. So we want your calls on this and your questions right now. Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, how the Everglades Foundation is using prize money to help solve the state's algae crisis. That's in our Going Green. All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, confused maybe about all those ballot amendments that are crowding up your November ballot? Well, you're not alone. There are 12 proposed amendments to the Florida Constitution this midterm cycle that you, the voter, are being asked to consider. And it's making for the longest ballot in the state in decades. Not only that, some of these amendments have been bundled together. What's that all about? Some are confusingly worded. There's a lot to sort out, and here to help us is Daniel Cronrath, professor of political science at FSCJ. Always good to see you, Daniel. Good morning.
Good morning, and happy Halloween, Melissa.
Happy Halloween. Yes, those ballot amendments are a bit spooky.
Yes, yes.
So,
the scariest thing this Halloween is our ballot.
Scariest thing this Halloween. We will try to take the fear out of it for everyone. Give us a call at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org. Tweets to at Melissa Injax. Okay, there were originally, let's begin by saying, 13 amendments, but one of them, Amendment 8, was tossed out after it was challenged. So Right. We would have had 13 to vote on. Now we have 12.
Right. And what the court ruled in that case is that the state Supreme Court has said in Florida that this practice that you're referring to that the Constitution Revision Commission used called bundling, which is taking seemingly disparate proposals and putting them into the same amendment and asking Florida voters to sometimes make a decision on two or three different issues. Maybe one you find very compelling and maybe the other two you don't, but there's no separation of the topics. You're required to, basically make a decision on all three. But Amendment 8 was struck because the legislature said that even though bundling is constitutional in this particular case, the language was too confusing and or ambiguous for voters. So the courts have come out. If it's a topic that hasn't been made clear, if it's something that they find is going to be confusing the voter, lead them down a path where they're not voting for what the actual effect of the amendment would be on the Constitution, the court has, in this case, struck Amendment 8.
Okay. So Amendment 8 is off the table, but let's go through the other ones, beginning with Amendment 1. This would raise the homestead property tax exemption by $25,000 for homes that are worth more than $100,000. Let's talk about this amendment and where do you stand on it?
Well, I think, first of all, I mean, in terms of where I stand on it, I think that whenever you're looking at one of the amendments which is going to potentially lower Floridians' taxes, they're more than likely to pass. Mm-hmm. Whenever you give an opportunity, I mean, that's just human nature. I mean, whenever you give somebody an opportunity to pay less money to the government, it's going to be appealing. In this particular case, however, it is going to reduce the amount of revenue which is going to be coming into the state. And on a local government level, this is where you're really going to see a lot of the challenge with this, because when economic times are not as good or robust in Florida or nationally as they are right now, this will potentially bind local governments in terms of how much revenue they can collect from its citizens in order to continue to provide basic services. And that's been pretty much what you've seen in terms of the opposition to the bill, which again, I will say, is very, very likely to pass based on recent polling.
But you see it in a way as robbing Peter to pay Paul, helping homeowners out, but at the same time, robbing them of what could be other vital city services.
Right. I think from, you know, my personal perspective and the perspective of others on this is that whenever you impose a certain restriction, you are in some ways eliminating or eliminating rights that you or things that you would like to do later if the circumstances dictated. So whether you're trying to, you know, put a cap on, particularly the one amendment, which is going to put a cap on commercial property increases in commercial property taxes at 10%, or you're talking about giving the homeowners a break on their property taxes, you are creating restraints in the future. If you need to choose to raise revenue through that way, you are creating barriers, which, you know, frankly, we could make those decisions right now without having to amend the Constitution in order to do that.
Which is really the larger issue with all of these amendments.
Yeah.
I see all of these amendments as just the abject failure of the legislature to legislate.
If
all of this has to be done through voter amendments.
This is, you know, Florida's on its sixth constitution. The last one we adopted was in 1968. And since then, we have amended the Constitution 129 times. So that's 129 times either through citizen initiative, the Constitution Revision Commission, the legislature, because they also can put amendments on the ballot, of course. 129 times we found dissatisfaction with the actual ability of our legislature to pass things that we as the voting public decide we do want to change the Constitution.
Okay, we'll go to your calls in a moment about all of these ballot amendments. There are 12. The number to join us, 549-2937. Now, Amendment 2 is also a property tax assessment amendment. It would place a 10% cap on the increase of non-homestead property tax assessment. Daniel, this will has a chance of passage too, since voters will read it as I'll be paying less taxes.
Correct. And this is going to be impacting, obviously, the commercial property owner or the property owner with rental properties. A lot of the opposition on this, too, from the rental property perspective, is that in reality, the market impacts what rental properties are going to be. I mean, it's a competitive marketplace. So, again, this may be a benefit to commercial property owners who are not going to be seeing their taxes go up greater than 10%. But to the average Floridian, this is going to be, you know, non-consequential legislation, except, again, impacting revenue coming into the state coffers in order to do things with that money.
Okay, let's talk about Amendment 3. This would give voters the power to decide whether a new casino could open in the state of Florida rather than leaving it to the legislature to manage it. So dog tracks, horse tracks that want to expand their gaming, it would make it more difficult for them to do so. People that are involved in the parimutuel betting world have been lobbying heavily about Amendment 3.
Right. In my case, and my particular opinion on this one relative to how it impacts the folks in our area, is that the way that the amendment is proposed to the Florida public, it would give the public the ability to approve new casino gambling on a statewide vote. The counter to that is, let's say, for example, that our situation in Duval County were to change, and let's say we wanted to take the South Bank here downtown and build a casino.
Put a Harrah's casino.
That is correct. And we approve a casino by local referendum. The next step for us is to have the legislature approve that. If you were to vote for Amendment 3, every Floridian in the state
would vote on
Jacksonville's new casino. That's
right.
Correct. So,
yeah.
You know, if you're talking about local control of issues, or if you're talking about the diversity of our state with almost 21 million people now, totally different political cultures and social cultures throughout our state, you're basically asking folks who live in the panhandle to decide the future of gambling in Miami.
That's, right. So yeah. If you're for local control of these issues, you're probably a no on 3.
That is my take on it.
Okay.
Yes.
Amendment 4, widely popular. This is the one that has gotten a lot of attention this cycle. It would restore voting rights to former felons who have served their sentence. This has widespread support, bipartisan support.
Yeah, it does. You know, libertarian groups, such as ones that are funded even by the conservative Koch brothers, have come out in favor of this. I think of all of the amendments, when we talk about things which are down ballot of the top races, which could actually bring voters out, this is one of the issues that you'll run into folks who are basically like, you know, vote yes on Amendment 4. We need to pass this. You know, having 1.5 million Floridians who don't have suffrage, who basically, if you've seen any of the news on this, you know, who have to wait 5 to 7 years and then just have arbitrary decisions made about whether or not they can get their voting rights restored. I mean, if we really have the point being, if we really have a Department of Corrections and if we're asking folks to rehabilitate, serve their time and get out, they need to have, in order to be fully integrated back into our society, they deserve the right to vote. We're the worst state in the country by many groups who evaluate voting rights. We're considered the worst state. So this is popular again, and I think that there's overwhelming support for it. You're correct.
And as we continue talking about the ballot amendments, we've only gone through a few of them.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, this is like a class.
Well,
today.
And Melissa, in defense, I have to make some sort of defense of the Constitution Revision Commission. The point with their bundling, too, one of their arguments is that right now we have 12 on the ballot. If they were to have separated all these
there'd
issues,
there'd be like 20.
Or
yeah.
30.
Yeah.
And it would become like a California-style ballot, if you've ever like heard of it.
I know.
Californians have 45 amendments to vote on this.
Well, you could have also made the argument that they didn't need to, not all of these needed to make it to the ballot.
That is also true. All of these things are things that the legislature could have done without amending the Constitution. They could have Past laws.
And we're going to keep talking about them. Let's take a few calls, though, at 549-2937. Victor in San Marco. Hi, Victor. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hey, good morning. You kind of answered touched on what I was talking about, how many were left kind of on the editing floor. But more importantly, why was an open primary something on the ballot?
That's a good question. Thank you for that. I think that did come up during the Constitution Revision Commission process. They did not allow that idea through.
Yeah, because to answer your question succinctly, neither political party in the state wants open primaries. They want closed primaries for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is that they don't want to have people crossing over to vote for candidates that they may feel are popular, that do not match up with their ideology. So I'm not surprised at all, because understand, the CRC, while it's a citizen-appointed commission, these are still 37 people who are political. They're
largely appointees of the governor and the Republican Party.
That's correct. Yeah. The speaker the legislature.
Yeah. So you have to look at these amendments through that prism. These were amendments that particular group of people decided should go on the ballot.
Listen, there are a lot of good things that could come out of these amendments, but outside of the ones that you will see, but they're all political. I mean, they're all political. There's some sort of political stake in all of these for a variety of groups. Whether the causes are good or whether the causes are nefarious, depending upon your opinion, they're definitely all political.
549-2937, Mark in Mandarin. Hello, Mark. Go ahead.
Hi. I have a question about Amendment 4. If someone has served his time and his right to vote, of course, is restored, and we know many, many of them will never reoffend, and many will. Suppose after he gets his right to vote restored, he's arrested for, say, armed robbery. And months later, he's tried and convicted and appealed and loses the appeal. And the appeal is made to the Supreme Court. And ultimately, they decide not to take the case and the appeal stands. At what point does he lose his right to vote? When all appeals have been exhausted?
Well, you're saying if Amendment 4 passes, future scenario like that appear to be? Okay, thanks for that question. I honestly don't know the answer to that. What I do know is that Amendment 4 would automatically restore rights for those who served their time, with the exception of those convicted of murder or sexual offenses.
Yeah, it doesn't protect anybody from rearrest.
Yeah.
If you're rearrested, if you were a felon and you served your time and you were committed another felony, or robbery in this case, as the caller suggests, you're still going to lose your right to vote again if you go through the legal system. As to whether or not, like, as your case goes through appeal, I mean, while you're incarcerated, while you're waiting for your appeal, if you are in prison, you're not going to be able to vote while you're waiting for that state to work its way through the court system.
Okay. And as you pointed out, Daniel, Florida is one of only four states that currently disenfranchises a former felon for life or permanently. There is a process to get your rights restored in Florida, but it's very difficult.
You have to pursue it. That is correct.
You have to go after it, and it's very hard to get the clemency.
That's correct. Correct.
Okay. Now, let's go through some of these other ones. We'll try to go through the bundled ones quickly. Amendment 5 would require a 2/3 vote in the Florida House and Senate, supermajority vote, instead of a simple majority to raise taxes. The legislature wanted this on the ballot. They want to make it more difficult to raise taxes. They want to make it tougher for themselves to raise taxes. So this doesn't apply to local revenue, but statewide taxation.
Right. If you come from the philosophy that a lean government is the best kind of government, this supports that notion, and it's more than probably going to pass, polling indicates, because, again, the way it's worded, it's us paying less taxes for the state to operate. However, to basically put and make it more difficult to pass a tax increase, who knows in the future what we as Floridians will tell our legislature that we wish to have funded. And now it will be a greater threshold for us to order to get that passed.
Okay, the next series of amendments, 6, 7, 9, 10, and 11, are all what we call bundled amendments.
Correct.
There's a bunch of measures bundled into one. This is where voters, if they even make it this far into the ballot, are going to be looking at this, especially if they're confronting it for the first time and going, what am I voting for here? What is this?
Well, let's talk about the one which probably most people talk about. It's the most fun to talk about if you want to find humor in it, is Amendment 9, which would combine your, if you choose, it's offshore oil drilling and
vaping
inside. So what the CRC or the Constitution Revision Commission said is they referred to this as a clean air or clean water, clean air, in terms of trying to make these two completely different issues, you know, seem like they were in some ways connected or relevant to one another. They're not. But still, you know, again, these are political amendments. Okay. Mm-hmm. You may be, if you're somebody who, you know, I don't know. It's almost inexplicable to decide or to come up with some sort of reason why they would be bundled. Why are we amending? The better question is, why are we amending our Constitution to prevent vaping inside?
Exactly.
We can pass legislation on that now without amending our Constitution.
The CRC meets once every 20 years. Now, I'm not a history major. Maybe you can tell me this. Did they go through this same rigmarole 20 years ago and dump a ton of amendments onto voters?
Absolutely. And, and you know, here again, this is one of the reasons why people are saying, even if there are things in Amendment 6 through 11 you like, all right, because inevitably there will be. There are some good things which would improve the lives of Floridians. There are a lot of folks who are passionate about Marcy's Law, for example, in Amendment 6. But that's
a victims' rights law. We've
correct.
Seen Kelsey Grammer doing ads for it.
Doing television ads, yes.
Yeah.
The answer, however, at the end of the day is that 20 years from now, sending a message clearly to the next folks who serve on the CRC that we are not going to tolerate these kind of bundled, totally unconnected issues, and then making Floridians choose, you know, basically, you know, what if you were passionate about one of these, but the other two didn't necessarily, you weren't interested in? You're forced to choose. And that's not what we're supposed to be doing with the CRC. We're supposed to be able to have a clear citizen-fed, this is how we want to amend our Constitution, and we want to be able to have clean decision-making, which comes out at the end of that.
And if you're just tuning in, we're talking about all those ballot amendments on the November ballot that you, the voter, will decide on, 12 of them in all, the longest ballot in 20 years in the state. Maybe that's because the CRC met 20 years ago. Give us a call at 549-2937 with your questions. John tweets the show, why are so many of these bundled together? It seems like pork barreling.
Yes.
Pork barrel, yeah. Is this pork barreling?
I think they actually call it log rolling, I believe is the term.
Yeah, I think you meant to say log rolling.
Yeah, log rolling. It's again, it's a way that if you wanted to try to get something through, you know, perhaps there's like something really unpopular, a poison pill, if you will, that would not be able to pass on its own. If you were to take a couple of things that were popular that Floridians would perceive, yeah, you know, I'll hold my nose and vote for this. I may not like the one, but I do like maybe the other two, which are on there. It's a tactic. It's a way really for the CRC to push through often a political agenda with things that they know won't be popular with Florida voters.
Mark out at Mayport Naval Station emails the show, what about Amendment 6? Judges are mean enough at age 70. Do we really want a bunch of cranky 75-year-olds on the bench?
Yeah.
One of this is one of those bundled amendments. Amendment 6 has the Marcy's Law thing, which is a victims' rights measure. It has a second provision that would raise the mandatory retirement age of Florida judges, including Supreme Court justices, from 70 to 75.
Yes. First of all, the latter, that is really rather funny. You know, of course, U.S. Constitution, or Supreme Court judges in the United States are appointed for life. Here we cap that at the age of 70, increasing it to 75. You know, why not 80? Why change it at all? The Marcy's Law thing has actually become a really, really highly debated issue because folks who are opposed to Marcy's Law, particularly organizations like the Florida Public Defender Association, the League of Women Voters, the ACLU of Florida, they see this as expanding victims' rights so much that they're actually infringing upon the rights of the accused. So there's a very, very fine line. They will also cite the fact that in the Florida Constitution, we already have a lot of victims' rights in Florida's Constitution. They're just not concentrated in one place.
I see. Okay. I hope that's helpful for voters. Michelle is in Springfield. Hi, Michelle. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to it took me 3 to 4 hours to go through all of the amendments, try to figure out how to vote on them. I had to take breaks in between because it was so overwhelming. How did we get here? I understand a little about what you're talking about with the CRC. How did we get here and how do we make it easier for voters?
I think you broke up a little bit, but really when the CRC began, there were 37 folks who were appointed by, again, members of the legislature and the governor. And for I think about a year, even here, of course, at the University of North Florida, they traveled the state. They got public opinion. They reviewed a lot of different proposals relative to community support. You as a citizen had the ability to go speak to them directly, to talk to them about issues which you found or you deemed to be important. And then at the end, after they were done, they took all these suggestions, they culled their work together, and they came up with the amendments that we're looking on our ballot. So, you know, to your point, why, you know, even though it may have been a longer process, why do we have 12 which have gone through and not 30? You're already doing your homework. In some ways, some folks would argue that having these bundled amendments is more confusing and more time consuming than just separating them out and having clean, simple things that you can make a decision on and then moving on to the next amendment. But to answer your question again, it was a very, very widely publicized event. They did take citizen input. There were a lot of things. For example, there was a lot of push for recreational marijuana after the medical marijuana, but it wasn't something that the CRC chose to take up. In the future, will we have a citizen initiative in 2020, 2022? Perhaps. I mean, it seems like that's the way our culture is moving right now relative to marijuana policy. But it was something that even though they had a lot of people come forward, they did not choose to act upon. They, at the end of the day,
made the decision.
That is correct. And they have that ability to make the decision on that.
Jacksonville attorney Hank Cox was involved in the CRC. I think one of the only Democrats appointed. Pam Bondi, the outgoing attorney general, she was on that body along with a lot of other government appointees. So
right.
People are tweeting asking who made these decisions?
Another interesting thing, because the Republicans have controlled Tallahassee, the Republicans had all of the input and knew who was going to be serving on the CRC.
Peter in Fernandina, you're on the air, Peter. Hey, good morning. Go ahead, Peter.
Hey, I got a question about one and two. It was stated in the conversation on one that might actually reduce local tax dollars to local governments. And my observation is that the tax bill is calculated by generating a millage based on what the local government's budgets are and creating that millage by dividing it into available tax dollars. So if you give everybody at $100,000 to $125,000 level another exemption, won't that just cause the millage to go up, and won't that in effect shift the property tax burden away from lower priced properties to properties that are above $150,000? And my question on number two was, if non-homesteaded properties are, if they lose that 10% cap, anybody renting an apartment or a house will end up incurring that higher tax rate if there's no protection, because landlords are just passing that on to tenants. So won't that have the impact of increasing costs for affordable housing? Those are my questions.
Yeah, thanks for that.
Sure. I mean, I would say to your first question, yes. To your second question, most folks that I've talked to don't believe that the market will basically influence what renters are paying. So even as landlords say were to try to pass or try to pass those fees, those additional taxes down to renters, there's still going to be a competitive open marketplace for renters to choose. And there will be landlords who just say, hey, you know, we have an opportunity now to you know, rent to new people or rent to more additional people versus somebody who's trying to charge more money. But typically the market will dictate that. At least that's what I've been gleaning on Amendment 2. But on Amendment 1, you're exactly right.
Bob in St. Augustine. Hello, Bob.
Hi. I just want to congratulate you on having the professor on and giving some real succinct analysis of what's going on. And I fully support what he's saying is sending a message to two groups. One, the legislature, do your job. And two, to the CRC to say, as voters, we're not stupid. We're not going to put up with this bundling process and reject those and do your job. And on the tax issues, I agree fully that all you're doing is shifting the burden. If you give that additional exemption, you're going to just have the local governments raise the property taxes because they have to support the services. And on the 10% cap, that's for the legislature to do. Just because it's expiring, if this doesn't pass, the legislature will address this in the next meeting, and they, as they should, and not have something codified in the Constitution that doesn't belong in the Constitution. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a really interesting, Bob, and thank you. You know, one of the things which is in terms of direct democracy, which is what we're really talking about with these amendments, citizen initiatives exist to basically, when Floridians feel that the legislature is not doing their job, that we, the people, can actually go about you know, go through the process of getting it listed on the, getting the signatures, getting it listed on the ballot. And that is our means to basically to express dissatisfaction with our legislature. If our legislature was, you know, actually responsive to the will of us, we wouldn't have to. We wouldn't have to do that.
What a nice picture you paint there, Daniel Cronrath.
Well, I know, but and this occurs regardless of the political party that's in power. To be quite candid, whenever you get a dominated, stacked state legislature with a governor for 20 years, you are going to get an ideology which creeps in onto that political culture, whether it's liberal or whether it's conservative, wherever you're at, and that's when you can see sometimes they will be ground in. They won't be reflective to changes within the state's attitude. I mean, just think about in the last 20 years, think about where our attitudes towards marijuana have gone.
Right. The voters were far ahead of the legislature on that one.
That is correct. Yeah.
And you've seen that in a number of states, both red and blue states, on different issues. Leah in Ortega Hills. Hello, Leah. Good morning to you.
Good morning. My comment's actually on all the amendments, I guess. I found a website called VoteSaveAmerica.com, and they've actually broken down all of the amendments for every state in just like easy language, very easy to kind of understand it. It's out of the like lawyer jargon, I guess you could say.
Yeah, okay.
So I just wanted to bring that up. I just wanted to like share that with everybody. Like, you can go to VoteSaveAmerica. It's a bipartisan website, so it's not, for any type of or side or anything like that, but it does break it down really in plain English, every single amendment that you're going to vote on. And then my other suggestion is bring a cheat sheet with you when you vote. It's way easier.
That's a great idea, right. Leah. Yes, it is.
But bipartisan, what is that anymore?
Yeah.
but listen, I appreciate that suggestion because I think that's one of the things that, in all 50 states, voters can be intimidated by what they see as jargon, as things that we wouldn't on a daily basis be able to understand just in our plain conversations. So thank you for that resource. That's something I'm actually going to share with my students too. So thank you.
Excellent. And then before we go back to some more calls, let's talk about the final two amendments, 12 and 13. Amendment 12 would expand ethics rules for public officials. Basically, it would prevent someone leaving a state government to immediately turn around and lobby that same government, try to prohibit the revolving door
right. Between
government service and cashing in as a lobbyist, or at least slow it down.
Right.
And then Amendment 13, which has generated a lot of discussion and eyeballs, is the one to end greyhound racing in Florida by 2020.
Right. Amendment 12, widely supported by most good government groups,
feeling
that this is a wonderful step. Amendment 13 talked about, obviously, I mean, we have a greyhound racing here in our viewing area, and this is really coming.
There are 17 dog tracks in the country left. 11 are in Florida.
11 of them are in Florida. And I think all of them are pretty much that are left are in the South.
So
you've had groups, the Florida Greyhound Association, the Florida Chamber of Commerce, of course, have opposed this amendment. But the wide, almost every animal welfare organization across the country, including the League of Women Voters, have said that it's time to end dog racing. It's something that's archaic. It's part of our past. And it's time to move on.
Jay on the South Side. Hi, Jay. Good morning. Thanks for holding. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was calling to comment on the amendments that were on the ballot. I was an early voter, and I'm a transplant. I've been here a few years, and we just moved. So this is my first time voting in the county and for here where I voted at, basically. And this is the first time I've ever seen amendments piggyback on top of amendments like that.
Yeah.
And the comment I had was, being a transplant, I had never seen that. So it wasn't so much confusing. More or less, it was like, why would you put an amendment for vaping indoors and outdoors with offshore drilling? Like you were saying earlier, it's more than it doesn't make sense. It's like you're making, to some people, it may make, you're looking at one issue and making the other one petty, trying to couple them together, and it's not like that. One of them is very important, and if it's not that, it's almost looking like the legislator has no common sense.
It's
the lack of a way to put it. I mean, that's the only way I can put it nicely. I mean, you
you literally have no common sense whatsoever. If you're sitting on the legislature doing this, you need to smarten up, man.
Thanks, Jay. Yeah, thanks for all those insights.
Jay, first of all, thanks for voting. Thanks for getting out there and doing that, especially being new to the area. It's great. And second of all, you're not the only one scratching your head. I mean, it's there are a lot of things that were bundled together. That when you look at for the first time, whether you're somebody who's a veteran of the political process, or whether you're someone who's 18, perhaps voting for the first time, and you're looking at your ballot saying, you know, what is this? How did we get at this point?
Let's take one more call on the ballot amendments. Early voting is underway now. Maybe you've already voted on them, but if you have questions, let's get a few more answered. Steve is in San Marco. Hi, Steve. Good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for taking the call. I just wanted to say a huge thanks for both the program and the guest today. But with all of these side conversations, before you sign off today, if you could just summarize the like thumbs up, thumbs down on all of these. I have not early voted, in part because I heard another caller say that she'd taken 3 or 4 hours to try to go through these all these amendments. So if you could summarize these before you sign off, that would be huge.
Okay, thanks. Now, do you want to tell your students out there, Professor, how they should vote on all of these amendments?
I will tell you, I will share this. And this, again, this is only personal. I did not support amendments 6 through 11. I did not support any of the bundled amendments myself because I wanted to send a clear message 20 years from now to the next Constitution Revision Commission that Floridians deserve to make decisions on an individual basis, up or down on these issues, and not having them jammed together. That isn't necessarily the case. You don't have to follow that. You may be a huge adversary of offshore oil drilling, and you go ahead and you say, yeah, I am going to support Amendment 9 for that very issue, and you should. I personally, again, as a political scientist and somebody who had a career in local government, don't like restricting the amount of revenue that we can raise if times require us to raise revenue, or shifting that burden, as the caller suggested earlier.
So which ones are you supporting? And let me just point out to that caller, the League of Women Voters of Florida has a really good voter guide on all of these amendments. They're a nonpartisan, good governance organization. The amendments they support, the only ones they support, are 3, 4, 9 and 13.
The caller asked me. I voted. I supported Amendment 4 and I supported Amendment 13. And
are the only ones you voted yes.
Yeah, Amendment 13 is actually very difficult for me because I used to really enjoy going to the Orange Park Kennel Club. It's fun. It's something you can do. But at the end of the day, I mean, it weighed on me. You know, my enjoyment as somebody to being going out. Versus a lot of the things and a lot of the press and a lot of doping of these animals, which has come out in recent years at these dog tracks. For me, I was willing to basically give up something which I deem as entertainment to think about the care and the health of the dogs. Everybody needs to go out, you know, hopefully this was helpful today, but go out and do your own personal research and, you know, vote your conscience. And that's, you'll never be wrong when you go to the polls, Melissa, if you just vote your conscience and you go in well-researched.
And keep in mind too, all of these amendments have a pretty high bar, 60% voter approval required to pass into law. These are complex, so do brush up before you go to the ballot box. And thank you, Daniel Quanrath of FSCJ. Always great insights.
Always a pleasure to be here.
Much more still ahead. Meanwhile, later, sparking innovation in Jacksonville. We'll tell you about this week's TEDx Salon. But up next, in our Going Green, how the Everglades Foundation is using prize money to clean up Florida's algae mess. We'll be right back.
November 11th of each year is the day that we ensure veterans know that we deeply appreciate the sacrifices they have made in their lives to keep our country free. Help WJCT honor our veterans during the month of November by submitting a name that we may add to our on-air thank you announcements. Go to wjct.org/veterans.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Well, for years now, it's been the scourge of summer here in the Sunshine State. Toxic green algae blooms that pollute Florida's waterways terribly. We've seen it here in our area along the St. Johns River, and it pops up in plenty of other places all around the state. The Everglades Foundation is using the free market to combat this pollution. They've announced four finalists in the $10 million George Barley Water Prize. And the goal is to develop a cost-effective and scalable technology to remove phosphorus from freshwater bodies in Florida. That's what causes the toxic algae blooms that are choking our waterways. We're taking a closer look now in today's Going Green as we welcome by phone Lauren Pera, director of the George Barley Water Prize. Lauren, so good to have you on the show.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Okay, so this prize is giving a really powerful incentive, a $10 million award, to companies that can find a way to clean up this algae. You're down to four finalists. We'll talk about them in a moment. But first, can you tell us a little bit about the history of this prize and how you hit upon this as a mechanism to address this environmental problem?
Absolutely. So it really boils down to the progressive leadership of our board of directors, who a few years back, shortly after the lost summer of 2016, looked at each other and said, how do we move the needle on this issue that continues to plague not only the Everglades, but water bodies all over the world? And so after years of litigation, of regulation, we decided to put some faith into innovation, and that was really the crux and the reason why we started and launched the George Barley Water Prize.
Okay. And a couple of years after beginning, you've made a lot of progress because you're now down to four very interesting finalists who will advance to the next phase. Tell us a little bit about some of these ideas to clean up algae in Florida.
Sure. So to your point, yes, we've narrowed it down to final four. We last week awarded them, and we also awarded a first runner-up. And so we've got really five technologies that are encouraging and have, quite frankly, already moved the needle on the economics and the science of phosphorus removal. As far as the individual technologies, I'm sure you all can understand some of our teams have got proprietary information technology, so I can't tell you too much. But what I can tell you is that most of our teams have multi-step filtration processes, but where you see interesting, innovative variety is in the media that these guys are using, that these teams are employing to actually filter the water through their systems.
How tough was it to narrow down the finalists? Did you have a lot of entries?
So when we launched this prize, we actually received over 100 applications from 13 different countries, which spanned four different continents. And to us here at the Everglades Foundation, that really spoke to the global nature of this freshwater crisis.
It really is global. As you said, to reduce the worldwide flow of phosphorus, even by 10%, would cost $3 trillion. That's a pretty heavy lift.
It is a pretty heavy lift. Last week, we actually hosted a technical workshop where the nine teams that actually all collectively participated in the pilot in stage three all were able to present their technologies in front of municipalities, stormwater treatment professionals, and a group of a technical audience that was really receptive to their technologies. But one of our contestants actually said, the only way to eat an elephant is one bite at a time. And that's really what we're seeing here with the George Barley Water Prize. We're moving the needle on both the science and the economics of phosphorus removal. And really, our teams are identifying new markets each and every day.
I'm sure one market would be Jacksonville, Florida, where we have this terrible algae problem in the St. Johns River pretty much every summer. And it's gotten worse every year. It just continues to get worse. And with warming waters and a warming climate, we're not going in the right direction with this problem.
That's exactly right. So what we know is that rising sea levels and warming waters are really not only worsening the magnitude of these harmful algal blooms, but also the frequency in which they happen. So we're really excited and encouraged to have narrowed it down to the final four and the first runner-up, and hopefully award this $10 million prize and find a solution to this problem.
Okay, so what happens next in the competition? How much more intense is this going to get?
To give you a good comparison, in stage three, which we just wrapped up, our teams were looking at between 2,500 and 8,500 gallons of water per day. That's how much water they were treating in their systems. In stage four, the grand challenge, they will be looking at an average of 1 million gallons of water per day, up to 2.5 million. So it's pretty clear that these teams are going to have to scale their technologies exponentially. And so it will take them about a year and a half to design, construct, and quite frankly, ship their technologies and get set up here in Florida.
Interesting. And for the winner, not only will they get bragging rights and the money from you, they could potentially have hit upon a solution that could make them very successful all around the world. Is that your goal? Is that your vision for this?
That's exactly right. Really, one of the biggest priorities for the Everglades Foundation launching this prize was finding a solution that could be commercialized and implemented easily around the world, which is why we're so focused on a cost-effective solution, a spatially conservative solution. And so a winner will have exactly 3 years to bring their technology to market.
Okay. Now, after this year's winner is announced, this is something that you do every year, yes? For people listening, and maybe they've never heard of the George Barley Water Prize before, are you planning something different for next year or the years beyond?
And so technically, it's not every year. The prize is a multi-stage prize that has essentially happened over the course of 5 years, we're expecting. And so at the end of stage three, last week, we announced these final four winners. Each of the nine teams that participated received $50,000 for completing the pilot phase and really their contribution to this science. And the four winners received $125,000 each.
My goodness. Well, this is fascinating to hear about. And I'm so glad that we could have you on this show because it has implications certainly for the whole state and the whole world. So thank you so much, Lauren, for being on the line to tell us more about this. It's exciting. We appreciate your time.
Absolutely. And for all of our listeners out there, I'd ask that you all follow us at Barley Prize on Facebook and Twitter to learn more about our competitors and their exciting technologies as well.
Excellent. That's Barley Prize on Facebook and Twitter. She's Lauren Parra, director of the George Barley Water Prize via the Everglades Foundation. And in a moment, speaking of innovation, how you can be part of it this week in Jacksonville at the TEDx FSCJ Salon. That's next.
Do you have a story to tell? Since 2003, StoryCorps has been collecting and archiving stories from all over the country. From November 18th to December 21st, StoryCorps will be right here in Jacksonville. StoryCorps is the two-time Peabody Award-winning nonprofit whose mission is to preserve and share humanity's stories. If you've ever listened to their NPR program, you know how powerful and touching these stories can be. To find out how StoryCorps can record your story, go to wjct.org/events.
Hours after 11 people were killed in a Pittsburgh synagogue, President Trump held a campaign rally.
We can't let evil change our life and change our schedule.
He is changing his schedule to be in Pittsburgh today, but not everyone wants him there. I'm Ari Shapiro, reaction to the president's trip, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
how cities have become the new front lines for integrating displaced populations around the world.
Every 2 seconds, a person is forced from their homes by fear and violence. At the same time, the world is going to be 75%, I believe, urban by 2050.
We'll be talking about that next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
They say that words matter.
Everyone has their own style.
But has the rhetoric at rallies gone too far?
I just don't think you can connect it to threats or acts of violence.
The White House calls it outrageous to blame the president for recent acts of violence. Critics say no one bears more blame than him. Who's right? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
It is your chance to be part of the growing network of innovation here on the First Coast and around the world. The TEDx FSCJ Salon Fearless Innovation is coming up this Friday. Here with more, Dr. Lourdes Norman-McKay. She's professor of microbiology at FSCJ. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Okay, this sounds like a tech summit, but it's not just that, right?
Right. It's about shaping innovators. What sort of environments promote innovation? What sort of personality traits do we look for in innovators? And fostering that to be the advances in tech and science and other industries, including business.
You will have a live stream that will connect with the embassy in Tajikistan.
Right. So the U.S. Department of State is going to be watching via live stream. And actually, the U.S. Embassy in Tajikistan is cooperating with us to present this salon, this conversation between innovators here on the First Coast and innovators in Tajikistan, which is a Central Asian country, part of the former Soviet Union.
Interesting. And that's typical with TEDx, but especially with TEDx FSCJ, being academics, you've really pursued this way of connecting people all over the world.
That's right. We like to have opportunities for our community and our students to come together, get a broader exposure, have important conversations, and connect to real world problems and scenarios.
Okay, so if people come out to this, and this is Friday morning, kicks off at 9 a.m. at the FSCJ Deerwood campus, that's at Bay Meadows and Southside, what will they learn?
So we're going to have a conversation about what does it take to be fearlessly innovative. We're going to speak with our business community leaders and here and in Tajikistan about how they manage teams and develop teams to promote innovation. And we're going to talk about how can we ourselves become more fearless and therefore promote our own innovations.
I think that a lot of people would like to be more that way, but maybe they don't work at a company that supports that kind of culture. Maybe they don't see Jacksonville as embracing fearless innovation. How do we change that?
Right. So change is always really hard and a little bit painful. And it takes overcoming fear of failure is a big part of promoting innovation. The truth of the matter is that any industry that wants to be sustainable and make advances has to foster innovation. A lot of times business leaders will get to the sort of end of the line or end of the rope on their business and they say, oh, we need some innovation. Go out and innovate. But you can't just command innovation. It has to be something that's grown as a culture. It has to be a fostering of critical thinking, of a willingness to take a chance. And I hope that...
And not punish those that take that chance if it doesn't work.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. And so I think that it's in everyone's interest to promote that kind of a culture. But you're right. You know, some businesses may see it too little too late.
Why, and that's so unfortunate. The marketplace, in the end, the marketplace decides. Companies that don't adapt and innovate don't thrive.
That's right. And also, businesses want to hire innovative people. And myself, being a professor at FSCJ, we want to train innovative people so they can go out and serve our community and our country as a whole. On our end too, we're looking at what do businesses look for? What is it that they seek in their would-be employees, and how can we deliver that from an instructional standpoint?
So you're inviting anyone from the public to attend, but also people from the business community. It sounds like you'd really like them to be there.
We would love to have them there. We have the live stream also as an option, but we'd love to have people in person to do that networking, that personal connection. Mm-hmm. So yeah, come out and be with us at 9 a.m. at Deerwood on Friday.
People can just walk in, right?
Well, you can go online.
You need to register?
You could register online for a free ticket. There is some limited seating, but we were going to have some overflow rooms to show our live stream also. So the more the merrier, we'll make room for you. And just go on to FSCJ's website. You can click on the Fearless Innovation streamer that's there on our main website and register for a free ticket.
It's this Friday, the TEDx FSCJ Salon Fearless Innovation, Friday at 9 a.m. at the Deerwood campus. That is at the corner of Bay Meadows and Southside. She is Dr. Lourdes Norman McKay, professor of microbiology at FSCJ, a very smart person.
Thank you.
And so thank you for being with us and
thanks
have
so
fun.
We will. Thank you, Melissa. We'll hope you come out too. I know you're going to be involved.
I will be sitting right here, yes.
You're going to be involved with us soon, so we're looking forward to that.
Yes, there's a TEDx Women event coming up soon I'll be excited to be involved with. That's coming up in a few months. But again, this Innovation Salon is this Friday, so register and attend. And that is our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Michelle Quorum is our director. The show theme is composed and performed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. And if you missed anything this morning, just catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross, and thanks so much for being with us here on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Creatures crawl in search of blood to terrorize your neighborhood. And whosoever shall be found without the soul for getting down must stand and face the hounds of hell and rot inside a corpse's shell.
I'm gonna do it tonight.
Stenches in the air, the funk of 40,000 years, and grisly ghouls from every tomb are closing in to seal your doom. And though you fight to stay alive, your body starts to shiver, for no mere mortal can resist the evil of the thriller.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.